It's a particular pleasure for me to have with me in the studio today two major figures of contemporary American poetry, Robert Creeley and Charles Bernstein. Both live, write, and teach in Buffalo, New York. They're helping me to initiate today a series of conversations entitled Books, 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 Intellectual Programming that focuses on some of the major concerns of our day and the people and books that address them. Charles Bernstein has helped initiate a movement called language poetry, which is curious to me because the poetry that came before language poetry was made up of language anyway. Robert Creeley has inspired the full range of innovations in American poetry since the 50s and 60s, including this new creation, language poetry. Robert, isn't the term language poetry a bit redundant, something like shrimp scampi? What do you see as the need for it, and what's the connection between it and your work?
Well, what Charles Bernstein does, for example, is to make usefully larger the sense of what language applies to, instead of simply the kind of language we would recall from grammar school, learning to spell that situation of words in that context. He, for example, takes as language all significant exchange of meaning between humans, whether gestural or word-oriented or written, or whatever, the full gamut for the communication and or exchange of meaning in the human group. So that leaves a happily wide terrain for activity and useful material. So ours was much more trying to hack its way out of the classic European and or the classic disposition of poetry we grew up with, Eliot and so on, T.S. Eliot, so that we were concentrating on the agencies of words, expectably. We were trying to recognize the diversity of our possible materials and the structures which they permitted, and in which they could continue to exercise, quote, meaning. So Charles is, frankly, our happiest dream of fulfillment. Having said that, I'll take a break.
Well, Charles, when you started out in a serious way, which I take it was sometime late in the 60s or early in the 70s, what had convinced you that there was a need for a different direction, a change in direction in poetry?
I kind of like that you introduced us as figures, because I've always thought how much better to be a figure than a person. Persons are so encumbered by particular necessities, particular circumstance, but figures seem like they could go in all kinds of different places. And perhaps late in the 60s or early in the 70s, you see, I even like that. Late in the 60s or early in the 70s, in and of itself as a figure, sort of appealed to me more than actually having to rethink 1968 or 1972. It seemed to me that there was an enormous impulse among myself and many of my contemporaries to question the kinds of authoritative language that were presented to us. That was the time of the Vietnam War. And it was a time in which the hypocrisy of the representations of reality that were given to us by our political leaders, as well as by our newspapers, television reporters, and so on, were so corrupted by their, you know, I don't know what to say, corrupted by their very mode of talking about things as much as by the content of what they were saying, that I thought, and not alone, that we needed to do something different. And what was different wasn't just to say the opposite thing, the war is good, the war is bad, but rather to rethink the whole way in which we described reality and our participation in it. And that process perhaps is not so different than anybody's initiation into poetry. when I looked around, it was fortunate to find a counter-tradition, an alternative tradition in American poetry, in addition to in other poetries of other countries, as well as human activities apart from poetry, which seems to suggest how one might go. And so in that sense, the sort of thing that Robert Creeley mapped out in his essays and his quick graphs seemed a very useful primer to how to begin to remap things. But this concept of remapping was crucial to us. So if we wanted to look into all the possible uses of language, there were many motivations, partly just the pure pleasure and almost giddiness of language, and partly that sense of getting out from where we were, from this stuck place of either saying the thing or the contrary. But as to the labels for such things, well, of course poetry is written in language, and yet there is something about resonating all the possible languages within poetry which has often been ruled out by the kind of official gatekeepers of poetic value, so that much of the activity in poetry that I most valued sort of never appeared in anthologies or in reviews in the newspapers. And yet there was this very, very vital other tradition that seemed to suggest a range of mining language that was both vast and at the same time just the beginning had been tapped, even though that tapping had been going on for quite some time. It's kind of an unlimited tapping become possible.
You both speak in a very distinctive American voice, if not American grain, and yet I think one of the things that you share in common has been your interest in European thought, thought from other places besides Europe. I guess I would like to ask you both, maybe you'd like to start, Robert, how is it that looking outside the possibilities for language in this country helped you find your own voice?
Well, it gave me measure for the fact that English, whether English or American English in all its diversities, whether that language in itself were the only language or the only way in which to think and or to feel the given world. And also, thinking of what Charles has just been saying, a coming of age in the Second World War was an extraordinarily emphatic introduction to the diversity and presence of many cultures, not one's own. I mean, to sort of go to sleep in a sense in New England and wake up in Bombay, to proceed then on to Burma, and to flounder around in the jungles whilst being, you know, bombed by charming people one hadn't yet been introduced to. All of this kind of grotesque displacement at the age of 18, and the fact that that army constituted such a wild cultural melee. Anyhow, I looked, as I guess anyone of my age hopefully looked, to see what others of like age and circumstance had felt about all that. So that a subsequent friend poet, Rainer Gerhardt, in the awful consequences of that Germany, René Lobiez, in the first significant translator of Pound into French in France, et cetera, began to have a cluster of nuclei of that order. Alec Trocki, for example, Merlin, Christopher Logue, began to gather this peculiar, almost, I suppose we came in some peculiar way, almost a flotsam, despite whatever education or cultural habit we might otherwise be identified by, but we were not either content with, nor frankly, were neither patient with, nor in real sense accepted by the securing tradition that was saying that was just a bad dream, come on home, there's a light in the window, simply resume your appropriate conduct and all will be well. I don't think after that nightmare anyone of my disposition could. It was not only a dream, it was a nightmare that was absolutely unacceptable to continue as if it were the truth. So that coming back into the classic humanistic frame of the university I'd left only a year or two, a year and a half before, was just no longer acceptable. That world was gone forever. shattered irrevocably.
You're talking about large political events?
Well, I'm talking literally about Harvard University in 1945, 46. I left in 45, came back, I left in, yeah, 45, I guess 44, came back in 45 with the end of the war, but also remember with the dropping of the atom bomb to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with the only to realize that a very within a year and a half the draft is reinstituted and the war in one real sense continues unabated. It's as though all that horror was not either recognized or permitted to find its own meaning, was simply submerged and et cetera, et cetera. I remember working at the tail end of the 40s along with F.O. Matheson and others, my elder teacher and friend in that circumstance, trying to get some kind of a political alternative to the static politics of that moment. Remember people like Wendell Willkie, et cetera, who were quickly almost laughed down, or Henry Wallace, then moving on to the Rosenbergs, to the Korean War, to the McCarthyism, et cetera, et cetera. It was, I think my generation is a group thing of Allen Ginsberg or Robert Bly or Denise Levertov or all of us variously, Robert Duncan certainly, or our friend Charles Olson, felt that postmodernism wasn't simply a comfortable bitterness, but it was an absolute, not anger, but an absolute faith or commitment that argued against the proposed reality of this status quo that we all variously had been born into. That Blueberry America is what Charles would probably call it. The 30s. The weird comforts of the Depression. Almost as though it were a mental depression as well as an economic one.
And for you, Charles, there was a war played a large part also in your beginnings of writing poetry. But then somehow, in terms of what Robert was saying before, there's also a desire in your work to open up the dimensions of poetry. Is there any connection between the politics and the delivery?
Well, I've been obsessed with the question of the relation of politics to poetry, and I usually think about that not in terms of the political content of a poem, but rather the forms in which poems take, that the forms that we speak in, that the ways that we speak, the kind of authority with which we speak, or the this kind of fantastic echo that just came on to kind of accentuate that idea that some authority speaks with a kind of hollow echoing and some with the voice of certainty. And that seemed to be more the area that had not been adequately explored. And so I think of poetry as a political act in the sense that it tries to engage meaning beyond the way in which meaning is normally engaged. We live in North America in a culture in which there's an intense insistence on superficiality at almost every level, so that on a radio station one gets a very limited spectrum of what possible kinds of speech there are. People are not allowed or not invited to speak in vernaculars and dialects. Obscure and weird music is not encouraged. Small groups of music are selected to be played over and over again to create a pattern of monstrous repetition. This constant formatting of television, of radio, of newspapers, of universities, even if it formats in diversity, even if it formats in a certain segment for the things that are otherwise considered to be left out, is for me a kind of political alienation from the fact that a true politics is a politics in which people don't understand each other, in which we're to some degree incomprehensible to each other, in which we have to work to understand each other. The common idea in our mass media that we should be understandable to each other, that there should be a few sentences that you say that will immediately be understandable to large groups of people, is pernicious in my mind. Rather, what's interesting is how we're not understandable to each other, how we're opaque to each other, how we do not understand other distant cultures, much less other cultures within our own community, much less other persons within our own families. And so to emphasize that opacity, to complicate language rather than to simplify it, is for me a fundamental political commitment.
Apropos what you're saying, I was always attracted. I think it's René Thom. He's speaking of I think he's talking about biology, etc. And he wanting to make a qualification as to meaning based in mathematics and philosophy. He uses the instance of humor, for example, how it is that humor is extraordinarily local. In other words, you can almost recognize the parameters of a cultural pattern by seeing where the joke isn't laughed at. Remember, in Homer, it's where the oar is mistaken for a winnowing fan. An equal way of checking that out would be to see where one's local joke no longer found or not. So what are you talking about? I don't get the joke. But it's interesting, why doesn't one get the joke? It's a simple joke. There was this woman and there was this man, etc. Very simple situation, but why isn't it funny? Because it doesn't have a locate, not so much a locating, but it isn't, you're not there when that's fascinating to me, and that's an instance of that resistance to generality that makes all simply similar. Wants a commonality, but almost a masticated generalness to all, almost like Orwell's sense of similitude rather than actual presence.
Well, I think one of the senses one gets in your own poetry is that in order for there to be a common space, there's got to be particular beings on each side of that common space, that the common space is not something that's mutually inhabited, but is a space that's shared with very particular people with very particular habits adjacent to it. So the idea of an adjacency to a common passage is what this concept of commonality is, rather than the idea of everything simultaneous and all at once, as if we're all, one thing, which is constantly reiterated. Not that there isn't great value in language that is immediately understood by large groups. Fire, for example, shouted, is a very useful in certain circumstances, but everything is not a fire. And at the same time, everything can't then be evaluated based on how it would communicate in the case of an emergency. And as with the great famous story where emergency slogans repeated over and over again lose their truth, we are basically in that situation. If there was an emergency, if there was something that needed to be said in that language, it wouldn't be believable. It would just be completely absorbed into the system that throws out these kinds of emergency or emergency-like rhetorics, not only every day, but every minute of every hour of every day.
The ozone layer, for instance, most moments.
So what's particularly resourceful about the tradition of the New American Poetry is this insistence on particularity as opposed to generalizations, whether they be rhetorical or romantic. The idea of somehow locating where you are when you're writing, the idea of locating the individual word and the individual sound of the word, to stop, to break the flow of message so that you can actually hear what you're saying, and actually take some sensuous pleasure in the individual words as they are articulated, so that you hear the sound and the feeling that comes through the sound, not somehow the meaning as being something that's separable. Many people feel that the sort of work that we're both engaged in, somehow it doesn't have either emotion or meaning, but the actual heart of it is the belief that meaning and emotion can come only through an acknowledgement of what you're doing, how it sounds. who you are, where you are. You can't somehow transubstantiate that into a non-particular material place, and just like an abstract voice coming from nowhere.
Well, for instance, Penelope was at sad occasion, at a funeral actually with our dear friend Susan Howe, and there comes now a moment in the service when all are to sing, and exactly at that moment Susan goes into an extraordinary intensity of singing these hymns, all of which she knows well indeed. And Penn said she felt a certain longing to be able thus to sing in the common voice with such familiarity and location. And I know that as a poet, what would have been, not just metaphorically, but actually that voice, I never found, I never found an ease in it. And I remember as a kid in high school being asked to memorize some poem for the high school class I was in. And I chose, we were studying Emily Dickinson, I remember, and I took Inebriate of Air Am I and Debauchee of Dew, et cetera, and came time to write.
Intoxicative Dew.
Yeah, whatever. I didn't remember it then or now. So now comes the great moment to write it out in the time given quickly. So I remember the teacher handing it back and said, you know, Bob, how could you write this? It's so unpoetic. And I said, well, I'd written, I am an inebriate of dew, which was, that was my New England. I could not, inebriate of, that was not the way you said it in West Acton.
But of course, it's simply, it's exactly, precisely, particularly, the lack of ease in the common that makes your work open up a dimension of a common.
And that's why I love Emily Dickinson, likewise. She has those edges too. And Zukofsky, I always felt.
But the edges are what we share.
Yeah.
You share the edges. But we have different ones.
Yeah, different.
You have different ones and different lines. Yeah. And a lot of files are getting opened up here. One that you mentioned, Charles, is the need for poetry to exist in with a live audience. And I'd like to go into that a little bit later. But Robert, in your line, there is just so much play and subterfuge, whereas when you get into the fully elaborated language poetry, there's so much play with capitalization and the way the lines are strewn out all over the page. What is the change that takes place from a kind of quiet subterfuge of the line to this more demonstrative opening up of the powers of words on the page?
Well, one thing, there is, in fact, more sophistication in the recognition of the resources of syntactical and/or structural shifts and changes. Also, I think what's interesting to me, there's certainly a great deal more confidence. I remember once in conversation with Louis Zukofsky, he was rehearsing for me, as he would say, the extraordinary difficulty it constituted to manage to drop the capital letter from each line of poetry. So that was an incredible effort to do that. I can remember in my situation writing the nature of poem I did, the structure I used. People had an extraordinarily, they could not understand what I was trying to do. Dancers would understand it, mathematicians would understand it, philosophers would understand it, persons in linguistics would understand it. But English persons, e.g. persons in characteristic of English departments, would not say, well, and that classic statement I carried for years was given me by John Frederick Mims, of a friend of his reading in some college in the Midwest, who after the reading invites questions, and someone asks him, that next to last poem you read, was that a real poem or did you just make it up yourself? It's as though all of my poems were, quote, I had just made them up, so what gave them validity? How were they, you know, how were they real? Et cetera, et cetera. I think that we were backed on, so to speak, the extraordinary, intense, diverse work of variously of Williams and Pound, H.D., Zukofsky, etc. Many more. The 20s are an incredible range of shifts and changes in ways in which one can think of structure. So that is simply a very small number of the full range of people who are there to refer to use as models. And we also had, I think, emotionally an impulse to not just to change it as to become significantly different, but it's interesting how diverse a group we are, and yet how insistently we go at this changing. E.g., I was thinking about John Ashbery. John and I were in college together, as it happens. And we were sat in classes and whatnot. We never curiously met in that vast emptiness of all being Harvard students, but we only met subsequently here in Buffalo, as it was. But the point was, he too was obviously displaced by the habits of containment that we were being commonly offered as model. And it goes on and on. Frank O'Hara in the same situation. Or Allen Ginsberg in Columbia or whatever. Not just that we're all in college, but the point was that the frames of statement and the committed meanings of those statements by virtue of their very structure, we felt had to be shifted and changed, because they wouldn't permit that which we... How to get said what must be said was Williams's insistence. In the desert music, he says, how to get said what must be said, only the poem, only the made poem, etc., etc. I think if anything, Charles's generation has a happy shift in this way, that they don't feel the desperate paranoid enterprise that almost all of us felt in various ways. There was a they and there was us, and those lines were drawn with absolute ferocity, whether they existed or not. We had that imagination that they were obviously trying to get us or diminish our, you know, abilities to get published or anything. So we felt we had heroic elders who had been, really repressed all their lives, some of whom in fact had been, as et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Charles's generation doesn't feel, thankfully, the need for such heroic scale or such heroic content as some figure. You got to call it a figure. That's another kind of figure, like a kind of curiously inside-out Trojan horse.
So the politics has changed, Charles, you think?
Well, I think maybe the generational difference that Bob is talking about between poets born in the 20s and poets born after 1945, let's say, is very significant. And... it's like Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire by the other Williams, who I like very much, Tennessee Williams, talks about the Napoleonic code. Well, the difference between the Napoleon, it's like the generational difference is a little like that in respect to forms. It's as if Williams and his generation and then Creeley and his generation sort of took those forms as innocent and sort of proved them guilty, whereas I think many of us take all of those traditional forms as guilty until proven innocent.
Then prove them innocent.
And by adopting that Napoleonic code, you have that giddiness, that freedom from the heroic that you're talking about. Because now I have this peculiar and odd notion of bringing back in even capitalization on the left hand, kind of 18th century rhyme schemes. I love all that stuff because it already seems guilty to me. So bringing it back, I'm almost like restoring some level of innocence. But I don't need to prove at all to myself that these received forms are themselves no guarantor of poetry, of truth, of meaning, or of authority, but are themselves contaminated, to use perhaps a strong word, contaminated by their association with claims for truth, claims for authority. And grammar, too, I would say, to prefer bad grammar, to prefer syntax that doesn't add up is to say that good grammar and correctness are no better than table manners when it comes to being able to eat. They're a way of showing that you've been educated, but that education itself is a way of removing you from some active engagement with the meaning of what you're saying. And I do think, to get into a kind of broad generalization, which I am myself suspicious of, but relating to what you're saying before, that the Second World War is, more so than the Vietnam War, a crucial turning point from this point of view. Because if you grew up, as I did, in the wake of that war, which the Vietnam War is really an it is a wake in the literal sense. It's like an aftershock like of an earthquake, and a bad, bad. In fact, the aftershocks can often do as much psychic damage and literal property damage as the original quake. But the Second World War is such a catastrophic event, and I can't say catastrophic without remembering what catastrophic means, which means bad strophe, bad stanza, bad
form.
Development, bad form. It breaks down any sense that somehow our Western tradition, our European tradition, our Enlightenment tradition, our rationalism, our humanity, our democracy, all of those things have some validity, because on the face of it, they seem not to. Now, I think, again, guilty until proven innocent, there are aspects of our Americas that are indeed not pulled in by the Second World War, but one has to identify them piece by piece. You can't just accept the whole cloth.
No, they're very particular.
And it's that identifying piece piece by piece, looking for the figures within this kind of dark nightmare that I think also questions the figure of the hero or the heroic individual, because it seems to suggest almost like too much authority vested in a gesture which itself seems questionable. Although
to so invest a gesture with such,
but that's again within a very different context. Growing up in the shadow of what was yet to be in the say 20s or 30s, well, so
sort of unexpectedly this afternoon, the suddenly flashing around, switching channels on television, I suddenly found myself, like they say, seeing the closing scenes of Moby Dick with Gregory Peck, etc. Well, Gregory Peck I think he's about 2 or 3 years older than I am. He's a contemporary, he's my generation, in effect. And what's fascinating in that film is the attempt to read that content and that scale, to reify it as visual image, to translate it, to provide an active reading of that text for now, to deal with the literary, with the rhetoric of the language, et cetera, et cetera. And I would be very interested to see what, say, contemporary persons 20, 30, would think of that. It's to me, it seemed kind of heroically inept. I mean, the whale alone, you know, crashing about through model ships, clearly, trying to get the appropriate vortex or whatever was cumbersome. And again, after Vietnam and all the violence of absolutely obvious kind, it seemed a bit mawkish. Or to think of, yes, the ozone layer is in danger, to think of this anger against the physical, the body itself, the not metaphoric any longer at all, but literal. This you know, Melville's text is magnificent, but this peculiar middle middle voice that film constitutes is like the Bible for children or something. It's just it's where the heroic really breaks down to my mind. I even wanted to correct Ishmael, is he, et cetera, et cetera.
So poetry.
Excuse me. Let me just tell you, we are 35 minutes into this, so you should be thinking along those lines. That's for Henry's benefit. The two of you just have to answer questions.
Okay, just one more riff, and then maybe we'll go to the readings. Okay.
Right.
So poetry is an act of resistance against large systems, against control. You mentioned before the...
or attempts to create those systems. I mean, it isn't modest or reactive. I was thinking some of our great elders wanted to make the whole world, literally, which that certainly take a big bite was Olson's contention. But again, I don't think one can make a simple exercise or a complex exercise for what poetry wants to do. It does what it does within its particular place and time. It doesn't. In other words, when Auden says poetry makes nothing happen, I could, if one thinks of it in terms of the Civil War in Spain and the political situation in which he's saying that, it's far more understandable than to make it a generality for all poetry in all times and places.
But of course, that's in a poem.
Yeah, it's in
a
poem.
He says that, it has to be read within
the
context.
So it's ironic in its context initially. Yeah, ironized.
And but in that sense, there isn't a poem or a poetry. There are many poetries, and that's one of the lessons that has to be constantly brought to mind. Poetry is not one thing. It's many different things with opposite and contrary impulses, depending on who's doing it, even within the same poet often. So that what I say today, I may say something very different, you know, tomorrow.
With that in mind, I think it would be wonderful if you could just demonstrate some of your production in the particular moments and circumstances in which you've lived. And Robert, are you game to read some of your
works?
Sure,
a little.
Good.
if I can find quickly. Well, for instance, we were talking of the common or having, and this, the common situation here would be one that would literally terrify me. Although again, as with jokes, this one is not understood far from far from home. Oh no, if you wander far enough, you will come to it, and when you get there, they will give you a place to sit, for yourself only, in a nice chair, and all your friends will be there, with smiles on their faces, and they will likewise all have places. That to me was terrifying as a prospect. That really depressed me. It's like going to the old folks' home or the VA hospital or or taking some tour with 5,000 people to see a beach.
It's see, that's one of your total scariest poems for me. Strange sense that when you have your place, that's really what's
that's when it's
to
really
be.
That's not at all pleasant. So that would be very early. That would go back into the early 50s. But I wanted, therefore, to skip to something far more recent. Well, thinking of other cultures and places and languages, one of the most complex languages I gather in our human world to learn, at least, is Finnish. It has 16 different endings, or nouns do, endless permutations of. It seems to be an orally qualified language. So the attempts to make it respond to literalizing, e.g., how do you write it, is still a curious dilemma. It seems to get its coherence basically from oral tradition, still. But anyhow, in Finland, so not so much excluded, but isolated by the fact of being not Finnish, although everybody in Finland speaks English. And also being at that edge of the Eastern European world, this was a year before the wall came down and much changed indeed. But because my generation had grown up in the aura of the Second World War, and still to that time in Finland, this was 1988-89, that whole disposition continued to be the authority of all our adult lives. Was that so? Ever since Hitler. Well before that, fact of human appetite, addressed with brutal indifference others, killed or tortured or ate, the same bodies they themselves had, we ourselves had, plunged into density of selves, all seeming stinking one, no possible way out of it, smiled or cried or tore at it and died, apparently dead at last, just no other way out. I've been reading a curious book. I was thinking old friend Harvey Silverglade, who's a Boston lawyer, one of his friends, colleagues, and respects is Alan Dershowitz, and I've been thinking about Alan Dershowitz. I remember his comments during the Kennedy trial and his questions about the judgments that were presuming this or that disposition of Kennedy's acts before they had literally had a hearing, and the questions about the conduct of the trial more generally. But I've been reading his book Chutzpah, which is a remarkable and intensive and, very often at times, certainly an emotionally, not emotionally determined, but emotionally experienced rehearsal of what being Jewish ethnically, nationally constituted in the world. It's as if as he speaks of, for example, going back to Poland, and also bringing suit against the Polish Catholic prelate or bishop who had questioned the arrival of a rabbi with company to protest the nuns, the Catholic nuns, who, et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, again, in the world in which I've lived, the information was often so hurried by. I listen now to, or watch and listen to ads for CNN saying, you know, 24 hours a day. And I remember the first time we had such cable hookup, I started watching the news, and I realized I was never going to stop. I would just be, I mean, the real world would otherwise take place. I was hooked into the news, and it was just like an endless show. Not that it was good or bad, but it was, you know, it was a conduit to some absolute irreality that never really, I never caught up with it. I remember watching Tiananmen Square in something like three different countries, and it was horrible information, yet came the day when that was old news, and now we moved on to new news. And it had virtually no consequence in that, you know, we're only here to tell you what happened. We don't, you know, we have, I don't know, it wasn't even, it was just saying, no, this is the news, you mistake it. This is the news. This is nothing more or less than the news.
And the poems that you write in the flow of events and time, do they catch up?
Yeah, they do. I mean, whether one wishes them to or not. I mean, I love Williams. Look at what passes for the new. News, you will not find it there, but in despised poems. You know. But I'm an old man, I've had enough. You know. He's at that point angry and not despairing, but yeah, angry that the world has not so much ignored him, but has so devalued what he cares about.
Hmm. Yeah. So one poetic question is, how do you break that attitude toward reality that you're a voyeur of it, that it's a spectacle that you're watching and that you're simply detached from passively?
Extremely hard. I mean, for instance, I go into the new Tops Market on the corner of Grant and Amherst, as it happens, and we live down just down there, and I think, how shall I make judgment as to the quality of this food? There's this vast array of food. I mean, I'm not permitted to open it. If I want it, taste that bread, I have to obviously buy it, and I have only other friends report as to what's good and what's bad, and there's no way I can deal with the multiplicity, whereas if I go to the old, you know, neighborhood store in Black Rock, I can ask the question and even try the bread, if that's the point, but that store can't compete with the, not just with the diversity of products, but with the cost base or any of the rest of it.
But when you get it right in a poem, you do catch up for that moment, huh?
Yeah.
You do say...
I mean, everybody's there, and I feel completely, not so much... I feel at home in the world in the sense I don't think I need, you know, I don't need a car, I just need to be there.
And Charles, when you formulate something in a poem, I hope you'll read now, if you'd like, do you also have that same sense?
Well, you want to break a circuit to reconnect a different circuit, and there are many ways and many levels, not only in the poem, but in some larger social world that we exist in as teachers, the three of us, mm-hmm. and also, in my case, as an editor and somebody involved in publishing and organizing a reading series. Literature is not just something that you hear about tangentially and you wait for the greatest book of the year to come out and read. It's something that you can actively participate in, and the good, the bad, the not so good, and the great all need to be kind of involved, as if you only went to a football game when the team was winning and everybody was in their top form, as if that's what a football game was about.
We went to that game.
or any other game was about. That you see things in the range of what they do, and players in the range of their potential, and you go to amateur games and so on. And here we have an enormous potential for an American city in Buffalo for the number of poetry events, and I think the one that I'm involved in coordinating, the Wednesdays at 4 series, which is widely advertised in Buffalo, readings at the University of Buffalo's North Campus at 4 o'clock on many Wednesdays in the spring and in the fall, are good places for people to hear what poetry is about as a live event where you hear somebody you're reading. And then we're also fortunate in Buffalo to have not the typical McBook, not the typical supermarket of books, which sort of basically screens out all the eccentric and odd items, but a store that is probably the best literary bookstore in the Northeast, better than anything in New York City, for example. I mean, here's something at Buffalo, in Buffalo, that is truly, you know, mm-hmm. a gem in the whole region, that no other, not in Boston,
no.
not in New York City, not anywhere mm-hmm. else in our region can compete to, and that's Talking Leaves Books. And the reason Talking Leaves Books is such a great institution is that those people make sure that they have single copies of individual books that people in this community might be interested in, mm-hmm. so that if they run out of a book, they reorder that particular book, and they pay that kind of attention to the poetry books that come in. So as a result, you have almost a kind of contemporary museum of poetry, books, and magazines at that store, the Talking Leaves Bookstore. And that's really the place to find out, at readings and in bookstores.
Mm. There's the Red Flannel series we should mention also.
Red Flannel series at the Central Park Grill, CPGs,
Monday nights, right?
Often on Monday nights, but often at odd times.
Yeah.
And, of course, the reading series of Just Buffalo. Yeah. So there's lots of different poetry events that are extraordinary possibilities here.
And we are an ordinary American city. So even though other cities can't necessarily boast of having YouTube people in them all the time, there are similar events going on everywhere. As Williams wrote, anywhere is everywhere. And the purpose of this program, as a matter of fact, is just to encourage our listeners to go out and dig into the cultural wealth that is all over this country.